This is CliffCentral.com.
Here he is. Can I just say? Justice Malala, the burning platform. It's brought to you by Nando's. Yes, Justice, what did you want to say?
I just think it would be great. Men would up their game because, sorry, the toilets are... Men's toilets are nasty.
Yes.
So if it would get men to behave.
Yeah, thank you very much. Anyway, it's Thursday, hey? Thursday, Duma is giving, is answering questions this afternoon in Parliament.
Is it the president's turn today?
Yeah, it's his turn.
It's been a bumper week. Did you see Batabile Dlamini yesterday?
It was quite something, wasn't it? It was delicious, to say the least.
She's, I've never seen anyone struggle so much to put a sentence together as she did. Do you think it's because she knows she's between a rock and a hard place, or because she's just basically inarticulate?
No, she shouldn't have been anywhere near being a minister. I mean, it's a shocker that she is. Yeah. But Thabile Dlamini's appearance in Parliament has been fantastic. And I'm sorry to start on this note. But I think we need to just acknowledge that our Parliament, our committees have become... basically, today, it's like comedy night. Mm. So this is comedy afternoon. President Zuma is going to arrive. The EFF is going to tell him to go jump in the lake. He's going to sit there giggling. He's going to answer some questions. And we're all going to sit there laughing and joking. He's not going to answer seriously. He's not going to take responsibility for anything. Someone will say to him, oh, what about those allegations in Jacques Poe's book? And he's going, I don't know. I mean, it's a joke. But you talk about Thabile Dlamini. Can we just talk about Thabile Dlamini, guys?
Yes, please.
Because the things that happened in Parliament yesterday and the day before.
All right.
So I sent you some of these lines, but I took them largely from Lester Kivitz, who's a reporter covering Parliament. He covered some of the appearances on and off. But listen to this one. The EFF Slope is MP. Slope is sitting there. But Thabile Dlamini says to her, points at her and says, she is blown up like a frog. And Slope responds, I'm not a frog. She's the one with a frog face.
That's a good one.
Another MP says, this is an ANC MP. Says we are dicking and diving on this issue. I don't know.
Is that ducking or dicking?
He's a dicking.
Duck. What's the next joke? This is great. This is like being in a comedy club.
The DA's team brought Seth says, firstly, I want to welcome Minister Dlamini to Black Label Wednesday. It's not Pizza Thursday. Okay? It's Black. So the DA heckles Dlamini. She responds at them. They are full of Black Monday, meaning they're like the guys who march on Black Monday. They're full of Black Monday. John Steenhuisen of the DA responds, you're full of Black Label.
It's like a good one. It's
great. Anyway.
So this poor woman, no respect. I watched a little bit of the Scopa hearing yesterday.
Well, I mean, you clearly have a lot of time on your hands.
No. I could manage 5 minutes. She was saying every 5 seconds. Mm. There was clearly, you know, like her brain was buffering or whatever. But the one guy, this Broadseth guy or whatever his name, what is his name?
Broadseth. Yeah, yeah.
He said something. Tim was sitting opposite her. And she was getting really annoyed because he was like kind of giggling while she was talking shit. And she eventually stopped everything and said, I don't like this guy laughing at me. It seems like there are a lot of people with very big egos. And she started to believe she's really important as Minister of Social Development. Of course, the one thing she's meant to do is look after the people who social development is charged with looking after. She hasn't done that at all. And the whole reason we're at this juncture and she's being hauled before Parliament is because she didn't do her job.
Yeah.
So there is a serious repercussion here.
There's a very serious repercussion. We've almost become inured to the fact that actually these people are supposed to be doing some great work. You know, and it's very sad that actually we've gone down to someone like Thabile Dlamini about her speech and so forth. If she armed an odd... but was making sense,
we would forgive her.
Then it would be fine. It would be, you know what, you've got your problems, and those are, but you are dealing with the issue. This is someone who has refused to appear before Parliament. They had to make threats. And that is why yesterday she referred to, oh, you know, some of you are plotting to send me to jail.
Right.
Because she hasn't appeared. But the whole thing about, on April 1 next year, the contract once again with the current provider, CPS, comes to an end. A new solution is supposed to have been found. So those 17.3 million people are supposed to be paid by new different service provider. It is November now. You can just see we will be in exactly the same place we were at in March this year, where we don't have a transition to a new provider. The Constitutional Court, the parliament said, you guys at SASSA, you guys at Social Development, need to sit down with the South African Post Office and get this sorted out. The minister appears in Parliament and says, actually, there are four deliverables, and the South African Post Office can only deliver on one. That's great. That's, oh dear, no, well, they can't do it. What she's saying is that the rest of the work, so 25% of the work or whatever percentage of the work, will be done by private business. Private business, so the one company that is doing it now is listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and that's Net One UPS, Cash Pay Master Service.
Why do we like these guys so much? Who's benefiting here?
If you listen to Batabile Dlamini speaking about the iniquities, the horribleness of white monopoly capital and these foreign firms, and we need to, you know, grow our own timber, grow our own companies, give them work. Here is the South African Post Office, an 87-year-old institution that belongs to the people of South Africa. And it says, its CEO Mark Barnes comes in and says, we can do the work. She says, no, you can't do the work. She says, we can do the work. No, you can't do the work. But
so it's her versus the post office.
It's her versus the post office.
She would rather give this work to white monopoly capital and to foreign businesses that want to come in and plunder?
Exactly. Instead of. And so you've got to ask yourself, who benefits from the work not going to a South African government institution to some other company? Now I'm pretty much a free market kind of guy, so I think it should be open up to tender and so forth.
And whoever can do it cheapest,
should do it.
Do the best service.
But to say that the SA Post Office can't do it, when, now listen to this. So Dondo Mukhajane, who's the DG for Treasury, comes in and says, actually, the technical team. So the guys who say, is your bank account speaking to your name on the system and so forth, that they haven't met. The technical team from SASSA and the post office has not met. Not what? She stands up and says, no, they've met. The technical team says, no, we haven't met. She says, no, they've met. What is going on here?
So I was sitting there focused on her bumbling and mumbling, but actually she was just lying.
On the work itself. On the work itself. So one, Mark Bond says, he sits there for 2 days. He sits there. He wants to cry because he's saying, we can do this. And she stands up in front of Parliament saying, no, they can't do the work. How does she know when the technical teams haven't even met? So they go into a meeting for 18 hours with SASSA Post Office and Dondo Mukhajane and Treasury mediating. They come out of there. Dondo Mukhajane says, no, we can't get them together. But these are people who are meeting for the first time. What have they been doing for the past 7-8 months when they were supposed to get this thing fixed? Where was the minister dicking and not going to getting them to sit down in one room together and say, this is what needs to be done. This is what we can do. These are the technical aspects of this and so forth. It hasn't been done. That is her job. That is her job. She hasn't done her job. That is why she's scared she'll go to jail, maybe. But that's where we are in terms of
Batabile
Dlamini. It's not even, you know, all this stuff, the comedy and so forth. The truth is that this is someone who shouldn't be in cabinet. The fact that you've had two cabinet reshuffles in the past 18 months, okay, where you've seen people like Musebenzi Zwane, you've seen people come in, you've seen people like Pravin Gordhan, Cebisi Jonas, Derek Hanekom, Ngwakwara Mahlaudi kicked out. These are competent, capable people who understand what the work of government is. So when we talk cabinet reshuffle soon and again, this is the discussion that needs to be had. Why is it Lynn Brown, whose partner takes money from Eskom, is still in cabinet? But Thabile Dlamini is still in cabinet. I mean, these are people who bring us to the brink again and again. They think this is Russian roulette or something. I mean, it's just not.
So
anyway,
Justice, this book that everyone's talking about this week, you know, every now and then there's some publication that comes out that grabs everyone's attention. And in this case, it's the Jacques Poe book, which Mabali and I have been talking about since Monday. The book is about Zuma's keepers, the president's keepers. And everything points to his guilt. In this book, I mean, I read the first and the last chapter, and I'm making my way through the rest. But it's not a pretty picture.
It's not a pretty picture at all. The most damning thing is that you have a president who works for the people of South Africa. He comes into office in 2009 after a 65.9% victory. And he walks into the union buildings. We all sit there, yeah, he's the president, he's in, we've elected him, and we're dancing, and, you know, it's all nice and well. The thing about what happened with President Zuma is that at that point, he was also an employee of a company called Royal Security. He appears on the payroll, J.G. Zuma. Now, he didn't declare this in parliament that, you know, I'm also working for someone else. He gets 1 million rand a month, okay?
That's a big salary for someone who... What do we know what he was doing for the company? Was he actually doing security guard work?
This is the question that Jacques Poe is asking. What were you doing for them? Because... first of all, if you're the president of South Africa, you're doing private work. I'm freelancing here, you know, a little bit on the side. If you're the president of South Africa, then you have to make major decisions on all sorts of things. You can push people to, you know, take decisions on all sorts of things. And you're being paid by some company. The company is run by a man called Mr. Roy Moodley, who is friends with Jacob Zuma, to the extent that in Jacques Poe's book, he had a birthday party where his son stood up and said, "My dad is the most powerful man in South Africa." And Jacob Zuma, sitting there next to Roy Moodley, giggled.
Wow.
You know, so for me, President Zuma should sue the pants of Tafelberg and sue the pants of Jacques Poe. It has now been 5 days since we read about these allegations, and he has not lifted a finger to say, "How dare you say I was freelancing? How dare you say this? How can you? I have been impugned." He's just issued a statement on Sunday. Mabali, you'll have got it in your inbox. It's a nice little one-pager, and it says, "The president has complied with all regulatory da-da-da," meaning, yes, he submitted his tax returns. Which ones did he submit? The ones for that year when he was working for Roy Moodley? For the whole 5 years? When did he get down to doing all this stuff?
And so very quickly.
So
what a quick turnaround time.
You know? But why isn't he sued? Because you know what? This liar, this racist, this whatever he may be, Jacques Poe, is lying about the president. He's making things up about him. So President Zuma is not suing. President Zuma is sitting there because Jacques Poe has all those documents and has been given them by whistleblowers in President Zuma's government. He can't sue. He is guilty as hell.
There are two things that have appeared to me in kind of contrast to a lot of the stories, or in tandem with a lot of the stories that are going on at the moment. The first one is to do with this whole issue of the president's tax returns. You know, I see these billboards up with SARS telling us, you know, file your taxes, do the right thing, we need your money so that we can build the country and make it better. And, you know, a while ago, SARS was a credible organization, and we didn't like giving them money. Nobody ever does. But you felt, well, they will be responsible. They'll be responsible with collecting it. They're not being predators. They're not coming in and taking more than they deserve. You felt like you were dealing with a business organization that knew how to do the pluses and the minuses.
Yes.
Now, most of us feel like we don't want to pay tax, especially when we see the likes of Batabile Dlamini in Parliament, and we think, oh, we're paying for her? Is that what we're paying for? And we think about the things that we've heard in stories like Jacques Poe's book about where this money goes once we've handed it over to government.
Mm.
And it makes you think, why should you pay tax?
I think, you know, I used to dismiss that conversation when people said maybe it's time for, or that a tax revolt is being triggered. And a tax revolt means that suddenly I'm saying to Sia, pay me in cash, don't put it in my account so that I can avoid tax.
Yeah.
Because why should I be paying? I mean, think about it. If you're an ordinary young South African and you're sitting there, you're paying your tax, and you read that the president of South Africa refused. He was begged, and Jacques Poe has a date and a time for a meeting where, what's his name, Ivan Pillay, when he was acting commissioner of SARS, went to President Zuma and said, please, Mr. President, I'm begging you, please fill in those forms, say what you pay and so forth. Otherwise, we are going to have to act. And you're forcing me into a situation here which I don't want to do. He begged him. No, he didn't do it. So if President Zuma shows the finger to SARS,
why shouldn't we? I mean, he's the first citizen. He's the one who's meant to be setting the example. And from a point of view of complying with the law, if he doesn't comply with tax, why should he comply with law? The other thing I thought of is...
Wait, let's just make a bigger connection before you go to your next point. Because last week, we were sitting in the studio. Anthea was talking about the SARS shortfall in tax collection. And that's 50.7 billion? 50.6? 50.67 billion. Yeah. Somewhere there. 50 billion rand shortfall. President Zuma allegedly owed 63 million rand for the upgrades on Nkandla. They actually did a tax assessment of this thing. So why do we have a shortfall? Because one SARS is not collecting from people like Jacob Zuma now, the new SARS with Tom Moyane at the top, is not collecting from them.
But it's also because the economy is shrinking.
But increasingly, are more and more people going to say, maybe I don't want to do this?
Mm.
A government that doesn't deliver on anything.
Capital flight.
People saying, you know what? I'm going to work in Swaziland. Because
I would rather own Bitcoin than rands. I mean, wouldn't you?
Lots more people are starting to think, why am I sitting there with this old currency that's being run into the ground? Maybe I should think about other things. Maybe I should take my money elsewhere and so forth and so forth. But this is where the impact is that you run a 50 billion rand shortfall, then you run a 100 billion rand. Remember that in the in June we had that, I think they had a shortfall of 30 billion at SARS. So actually what you're doing is you're worsening and worsening and worsening the tax collection. You're worsening things to such an extent that you're getting to get to a point which was predicted, and people made all sorts of getting to a point which was predicted by R.W. Johnson. You're going to go begging for money from the IMF. And the IMF will say, why are you paying 17 million people social grants? Why are you paying your civil servants so much money? And they're going to go for you. So this thing goes one way.
You're not in charge of your own destiny as a country anymore. Because
you're run by Washington.
And maybe that's what we need, because we're not disciplined. Our government can't seem to control their spending, and they can't seem to do a decent job of income collection, of tax collection, especially when it comes to the president.
You can't do a decent job.
But there's another parallel. There's another parallel here. We're all outraged by people like Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby, and now Danny Yordan is being accused of rape as well. But here's our president who was accused of the very same thing. Now, he was found not guilty by the court, which we accept. Mm. The court must have done a fair amount of work. But we know the story of Kwesi. And Aridi Tlabi's written a really good book. I mean, in parallel with Jacques Poe's book about the finances and how rotten that is. Aridi's book is about this woman's story and how she was victimized. And there's a kind of toxic and ugliness to the president's masculinity, which people aren't willing to discuss too much either anymore. Mm. But it's not something that's gone away. And it could inform the way that he behaves in other ways.
I think...
If we're going to get upset about Harvey Weinstein, we need to equally get upset about him.
And we haven't really gotten upset. I mean, I've been interested in that. Questions have been asked of people like Lindiwe Sisulu, others, about what do you say? Because you organized rallies and so forth in support of Jacob Zuma and so forth. I think there is so much around Jacob Zuma that is cause for outrage that we're not outraged about. So let me go back to when we started, you said no more analysis. You know, this is just commentary. And by that, I wanted to say, one of the things about what we're going through is that so much is tumbling out of the closet now. So much is just keeps on coming, and it's dirty and it's debilitating, and it's, we all sit there and it's you know, oh my God, see, I can't believe this is happening, and it's happening, and then, oh my God, Mabal, did you hear? And you know, I walk in here,
punch drunk.
Yeah. So in a way, we almost can't say, this is what's happening, this is what it means for what will happen in June next year. What we're going through is almost the death of analysis, because it's just too much. We're in it because every day Jacob Zuma says something, does something, acts in a way that we all think, oh my word. But he's acted that way for 10 years, whether it's the sex, the allegations that you refer to, rape and crazy and so forth. Or it's other things, his indebtedness to dodgy characters and so forth. So now we actually just commenting as it comes out, a story comes out, we comment quickly and we move on. But in terms of saying, what do listeners of this podcast, of this station, how can they navigate the future given what is happening now? It's almost like we've come to a standstill. It's just more of the same rot. So you can. So we just go through. We tick the boxes. Oh, it's Batavile. We know she's. You know, there's corruption there, and there's terrible lack of governance. And then we go on to, what's happening with Zwane? Terrible lack of governance, corruption. Oh, what's happening with Lynn Brown? Terrible lack of that. And you know, and basically our politics have been hollowed out. They've been our politics have become useless almost. They've become a round robin of how horrible it is, none of our politicians is giving us a glimpse of none of our politicians, let me say ANC politicians or politicians who are in government now, give us not an idea of what the future could look like, what kind of future we need to do to
there's
get
no
to
vision.
The future. There's no vision. There's no so you know, it's almost we are news analysts almost, because we look at the news, we are shocked, and the same thing happens. The next week we'll have another 7-point diary and we'll talk about it. But actually, the next 6 weeks, the next 8 weeks, maybe through to January, we're almost stuck in a moment, and we it's just debilitating. One, you get beat up, boom, boom, boom. And the last chunk of it is because Jacob Zuma has brought us here, and you know, people say you can't blame one man, but one man and the culture that he embodies, and it's whether it's a culture of patriarchy that you refer to now, or culture of misgovernance, culture of this, but he's brought us to a point where it's just stuff. But that stuff has a consequence. Everything's going down.
Can we, while we're on this stuff, because there are other things I want to address too, just quickly look at what Peter Hain has been doing, because he keeps dropping bombshells on the Guptas.
Yes.
What's going on there? Explain it to me.
What's going on there is interesting. So first of all, you know, we are beginning to see an interesting thing and its consequence in the system. Not in the South African system, but we are in a global world. And the FBI we had is looking into the Gupta transactions in the US. We've had murmurings elsewhere in the world that, oh, people are doing this. But what Peter Hain did is focus on transactions made by the Guptas into bank accounts in the UK. And he said, if you're aiding and abetting the theft of money from the 80 people who were going to benefit from the Vrede dairy farm in the Free State, then you are part of the Gupta rot. So he, in Parliament yesterday in the UK, can't remember whether it's the House of Commons or the other one, House of Lords, I think it was, he gave a stonking, rollicking speech in which he outlined what he had done to bring two British banks to account. And it's HSBC, which is an international bank, and another one which he didn't actually quite name, because he said, in fact, he named them, Standard Chartered Bank. And he said they had actually taken some steps. But the key thing is that money was taken from various entities, then pushed out to the rest of the world, then collected again, and then brought back to South Africa, for example, to pay for the wedding in Sun City. I hope none of you guys were there.
No invite.
You didn't get invited, Mabs?
Sorry, Mabs, sorry.
I don't really think I'm the type of person, though, the Guptas.
See, I went.
Awkward silence. Anyway,
I don't mean to, you know, show off or chat about such. So let's move on, please.
Anyway, so what Peter Hain managed to do is show that these guys took money out, then, you know, put it in various shell companies, and then brought it back here. But these banks aided and abetted that. Some young people in those banks said, oops, sorry, this doesn't look right. This looks like money laundering. Why do these guys have so many shelf companies? What's going on here? There are too many connections. It looks like people are washing dirty money. Which is what was happening. So he's saying now, I'm going for you, the banks, because I can't get those guys. And if I go for you, and maybe there's some consequences, those guys can't come to the UK and maybe the Eurozone. So he's written letters to the Eurozone, the banking authorities in the whole of the EU. He's written to the heads of money laundering financial institutions in the UK, and he's saying, let's have an investigation and let's bring one, the bankers, to book. 3 months in jail you could get, and massive fines if you aided and abetted. And he says, let's make sure that we get these guys. If we can't get them, we'll get those who help them along. And those who said to those young bankers, oh no, ignore that, just keep on doing it because we make a lot of money from these guys. And we are going to a point where the Guptas in the UK, in the US, the Guptas in the UK, the Eurozone, will find themselves in big, big trouble, because they'll be named and they'll be on Interpol in all those countries saying, this guy moved money from here to here to here. Money launderer, money launderer, money launderer. Don't allow him banking here. Don't allow him banking here. And so forth and so forth. So that, for me, is a positive step. The biggest question remains, everyone all over the world is jumping up and down. Where is Sean?
Sean the sheep.
Nothing. Nothing. Still nothing. Where are the hawks? The hawks are saying, oh, we'll get on a jet plane and go to and speak to the FBI. They could just drive from Tshwane. I think they have offices in Joburg as well. Drive from Tshwane, get on the N1, very good road, two e-tolls, boom, you're in Sachsenwald, and you can do this. If they think they might get lost, they should ask Jacob Zuma. He's there all the time. Give me directions, chief. But no action in South Africa. I mean, this is why it's so depressing, actually.
Well, there's
no action in South Africa.
It's worth giving credit where credit's due to one or two good people. And one of those people is a statistician general, Palile Hotla. I saw you retweeted something yesterday about a good civil servant who's now retiring.
Yes, indeed.
And we're sad to lose him. He's been around for a long time. He's done an excellent job.
He's been around for 17 years, I think, since 2000.
Another good man gone from the apparatus.
Very good man. But, you know, for me, people like Padile Hosa, they fascinate me because argument in South Africa can be very emotional, can be full of all sorts of stuff. So we'll say all kinds of stuff. Oh, young people are lazy, you know. But nothing to back it up. With Padile Hosa, you'd say the Jacob Zuma government said it will create 600,000 jobs or 5 million jobs or whatever within the next 5 years or the next 10 years. Paddy Lehotla will give you the numbers that say, like Statistics SA said yesterday, the day before, that the unemployment number was 20% in 2009 when Jacob Zuma came in. It is now 27.7%. The absolute number of people who are not employed were this number in 2009. It is now 9.24 million. I love that you can say, no, it's not me saying this. Under Jacob Zuma, unemployment has gone from 20% to 27%. These are the figures. These are the numbers. They are absolute. They are reported by business saying we are retrenching so many. We are employing so many. Here are the numbers. We know. That's why we need people like Padile Hotla in the world, in our system, that we know it. If we say inequality, what is it? How many? If we say poverty, he gives us the numbers. 30 million South Africans just barely getting to the poverty line. You know, this makes argument, this makes debate, this makes policy making powerful because you can say, we need to do something about this. This is what the numbers say. That's why I wish many more of us followed what he did and followed his example, really.
Well, the Auditor General yesterday, and this is to your point about the 50 billion SARS shortfall. Mm. So if SARS have a shortfall of 50-odd billion, the Auditor General just yesterday reported 40 billion in irregular government expenditure. So that's almost the entire amount of the shortfall that we could recoup if we didn't have irregular government expenditure, and that's without corrupt money that's been stolen.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we don't know about that.
So,
we could easily make up the shortfall if we just weren't stealing so much.
We shouldn't have a shortfall. That is just...
isn't that an interesting... It's so close.
Yeah, it's very
close.
We could
cover that cost.
But this is money that he can see. So it's
Education department.
Yeah, education department says, we're going to build a school and the invoice comes in, but there is no, you can't verify that this the school with enough classes and so forth. So there's no paperwork. Money just sloshes out.
Mm.
So a lot of this stuff is, a school is built for 30 million, but actually it could have been built for 12 million, but 18 million's gone to my friends who happen to be there. That's just one example. You could use all sorts of things. Hospitals, if you look at, you know, the state of the hospitals, whether in Gauteng or the Free State, is a good example where things just fall apart. But money just keeps on sloshing into these departments. And And we could, I mean, if you want to save, if you want to make things happen, you could make things happen. But you've got to have political will. But that's an interesting number because that's your 50.7 billion, whatever it is.
Yeah, there's our shortfall.
Yeah.
Okay, we could carry on talking about the state of capture report, but I think we're sort of done with that. And maybe we can pick it up once something happens.
Well,
the president's
this afternoon, the president will be asked again and again and again. He'll do all sorts of things.
Let's rather look at farm marches and why the carrying of the old flag is so terrible.
Yeah, I just think, so much has been written and said about what happened on Monday. And a lot of it is around the flags and the carrying of the flag. If farmers want to protest about murders on farms, they must do it. They should just do it. They should just go ahead and go and do it. What happens when someone carries the apartheid flag to those marches? The first thing is that if you listen to, say, that young woman and the guy, the two people who are actually the initial organizers of this thing, over and above the farmer who posted that video, they said, we believe in the new South Africa, we believe in this and so forth. The hearts seemed in the right place and so forth. But all those people who arrived, and not the fake pictures, but those people who genuinely arrived with the old apartheid flag, with that flag on their insignia and so forth, did so much damage to that campaign, did so much damage to underlining that.
Totally poisoned the well.
Totally poisoned the well. So here,
and for the average black South African to see that means, oh no, these people have not moved on at all.
Yeah. So this is not about people being killed. This is not about, it's a totally different thing. So here we are, 4 days later, we're not talking about murder in South Africa. It would be nice to have a debate about, guys, do you want to talk about the 19,000 murdered over the past year? Or do you want to just talk about the 71 farmers who've been murdered? Or do we want to make this part of a bigger conversation about the fact that actually we're losing on crime? We're losing on murder. We're losing on all contact crimes. We're losing on all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And that's the conversation. Whether it's a white farmer or a black farmer, a white farmer or a black farm worker, or an ordinary black person who dies in
soil. Can't people, farmers and workers, be safe on farms?
Exactly.
From each other and from predators outside.
Exactly. That is the... If you could...
But isn't it almost worse justice when there are already these racists out there who we know feel a certain way and will brandish this flag? That's bad.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like it's wantonly mischievous in a very divisive Bell-Pottinger way when journalists post pictures that are not attached to that event to try and make it look like that event is much worse than it
is.
I mean, that to me is outrageous.
I mean, I'm outraged by it, but I mean, there are two cases, and the cases that interest me is one, Andile Mkhithama, and the other one is Nicholas Bauer at ENCA. Now, Andile Mkhithama posted a picture by Alan Skye from 2010 or 2012. I can't remember.
There was that Sunet Bridges.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a racist convocation.
Exactly. So Andile wanted to...
He's a shit stirrer. That's what he does.
That's what he does. So for me, there is... what do the Latins say? It's malicious, there is bad feeling, there is bad
motivation. But we also know, I mean, we talk about that, the whole Gupta thing, and his credibility just dissipates. I'm not concerned about it.
So someone like Nicholas Bauer, do I believe that he did that because he wanted to make a point that these are racist, da da da? I'm not sure that. I think he genuinely believed that these were pictures from the day which had been tweeted by other people, and he put them in whatever he said.
People don't follow him because he's an outspoken political activist. People don't follow him because he's an instigator like Andile. People don't follow him because he's a celebrity. People follow him because he's a journalist. And if you're a journalist and you post the stuff, it's you're asking to be called fake news.
Yeah. I think in this climate, you're
taking a huge risk with your reputation.
I think in that sense, I agree with you that, you know, we all need to be very careful about the kind of stuff that we...
But this old flag, I've got to say, like as a white guy who has an appreciation for history, I think that this old flag must be put away. Why are people still brandishing it? Why would anyone want to have it on their clothing? To me, that's just so backward. It's like those Confederates in America who wear that flag. You know, there's nothing wrong with appreciating your past. And in South Africa, there's a lot for Afrikaners and farmers to be proud of. They've done a lot for this country. And they've also done a lot of bad things for this country. But what we've got to do is stop worrying so much. Stop clinging to those things. Try to make a positive contribution. And if you really mean that you want to be a part of a progressive, positive future in this country, you have to let go of these icon, these symbols of something that is dead.
But you know what? You know, a lot of people, and I saw something, there's a very good post on Huffington Post essay by the head of Agri SA. And, you know, I follow the farmers every so often because I'm interested in some of the stuff that they do. But he made some incredible points about this is the South Africa we want. This is what we, as farmers and representatives of farmers, this is... The past was a terrible thing. Don't take anything that we say and try to tie to your hankering for the past. This is about us and the future of South Africa. And it was such a powerful thing to post that it speaks to food security, to change, to transformation, to being happy on your farm.
Also,
stuff like that.
What's in people's hearts? Exactly. The minute you have that flag it kind of discredits you. It's like when Andile tweets about how the Guptas are saving South Africa. We just can't take you seriously.
But the thing is this, people need to be aware that that flag represents so much that is hateful about our history. Absolutely. That you don't need to even do it. But, you know, sadly, there are people who will do it again, and it will happen again.
Yeah, I, and you know what? Farm murders are going to carry on, I'm afraid. This march probably won't have an effect. It's like when COSATU march and doesn't necessarily change the lives of most workers. It's like when Zuma must fall, people march and he doesn't fall. You know, but you should always have the right to protest, and people will criticize your protests, and that's fine. That's part of being in a free society.
Yeah.
Not everybody's going to join in.
Not everyone will join in, but don't shoot yourself in the foot. Imagine there's a march today, I think, in Pretoria to the Israeli embassy.
Oh, yeah?
And, you know, some streets will be closed and so forth. There are many people who disagree with the state of Israel, who have issues with the way it's behaved in Palestine and so forth and so forth. But... if you really want to show that you are not about protest, then you take a Nazi flag to that march today.
You ruin all the credibility.
You ruin everything about that march.
Absolutely. So, great correlation, actually.
So people need to be aware of these things, and that if you have a genuine, and many people have, I have, a genuine issue with the fact that we're not fighting crime in South Africa, that in fact basically we've said those who do not have private security will never see the rapist
fighting
their
crime. We seem to be for it. Our president seems to be very much for it. We're not a fighting crime nation.
No, we
seem to be very proud of how much we can get away with.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a big problem there.
The list is never ending. Next week, we'll catch up with you again in the Burning Platform, and we'll hopefully be able to laugh a little bit about what the president gets up to in Parliament today. But it's no laughing matter in the long term, and people are going to end up having to carry the cost of all of this mess.
You know what I'm looking forward to? The ANC had no National Executive Committee meeting scheduled until a few days before the conference in December. They are calling one for next week.
Oh.
So the last time this sort of thing happened was when under Thabo Mbeki, under Jacob Zuma in 2008, and they called a special meeting and they asked Thabo Mbeki to step down. Hmm. I don't think this is going to happen, but it's very interesting that they've called a meeting to discuss things. It could be all manner of things.
When are they meeting?
I don't have a date yet, but it's supposed to happen next week sometime.
Hmm.
But one of the things they're talking about is, you know, the nominations process and so forth. And I don't know what we'll come out with, but will it be that the ANC says, oops, we're not having a conference in December? Or it comes out and says, oops, Jacob Zuma, this Jack Poe allegations. But no, I don't think that's going to happen.
I had an interesting interview yesterday with Karine Duplessis about her new book, which is called Women in the Wings,
yes,
about Nkosi Sanat Dlamini Zuma. And it's worth a listen if you have a gap for a podcast today. You'll find that on cliffcentral.com under my guests. And it was a full hour where we got to talk about the career of Nkosi Sanat Dlamini Zuma, her role as a wife and a mother, her role during the struggle, her qualifications, her academic pursuits, the fact that she didn't want the job of Minister of Foreign Affairs, the fact that Thabo Mbeki might have been grooming her for president, and whether or not she could win in December and what that would mean for South Africa. Mm. She's a very enigmatic woman. There's not a lot we actually know about her.
No, and she has been very reticent with interviews to mainstream media, if you will. She has been very free with ANN7, but that's about it. And she remains, even in this race, someone very much not out there. She'll go to very managed events like ANC Youth League, ANC Women's League, but she hasn't come out and, you know, look at someone like Lindiwe Sisulu, who goes out there, makes mistakes, gets...
But we'll talk to anyone.
You know, yeah, but we'll talk. We'll talk and talk and talk.
While I was talking to Karine, I drew some similarities between Nkosi Sanat Dlamini Zuma's campaign and that of Hillary Clinton. And also the way that the similar sort of adjectives that were used for him, Hillary Clinton, are used with Nkosi Sanat, aloof, you know, slightly cold, kind of... has the ex-husband in the case of Nkosi Sanat, has the husband in the case of Hillary, and how none of that stuff seemed to do her very much good, and also the fact that she isn't accessible.
Yeah.
And that there's no real emotional connection there, which is something that Hillary dealt with in that election.
Yes, very similar, actually. It's quite a, very similar.
You may want to listen to it. All right, thank you, Justice. Very good. The Burning Platform with Justice Malala, always a bumper episode, and this week no different to any other. Next week we'll return, and hopefully we'll have some really, really exciting breaking news that Justice alluded to in that ANC-NEC meeting, or not. Or not. It's not as if it's going to be a boring week.
No, it's not.
Thank you, Justice.
This is CliffCentral.com.